It's really like it or lump it. If the US goes to war, Australia is going to be there quite possibly in some way. So the role of US Secretaries of Defence have had a role in Australian history as well. Joining us this morning is Paul Monk, historian and co-founder of Austhink Consulting, who joins us to talk about the book that has just been written, Robert Gates, US Secretary of Defence. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Trevor. How are you this morning?
Good, Paul. Firstly, can you talk to us about why we should recognise the role that Bill Gates has as part of Australian history as well as part of our involvement?
Just a quick correction. It's not Bill Gates, of course, but Robert Gates.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
And then their relations.
It's very, very different.
Both important to Australia, you know. Look, I would make 3 points. The first is a relatively trivial one, but when the book was released in January, there was some press coverage. And people chose, among other things, to highlight an incident where Gates was in Australia having a dinner at Yarralumla with Kevin Rudd when Rudd was Prime Minister. And the anecdote was that Rudd got into a long monologue about Australian history and had only got as far as Anzac when Gates fell asleep at the dinner table.
That's right, I remember that.
And this was supposed to be, A, humorous, and presumably an indication that Gates, embodying the United States, really wasn't very interested in Australia and its history. But let's just first correct that anecdote, because when you read the actual memoir, what you discover is that the reason he fell asleep at the dinner table, or at least nodded off, is that he had had an accident not long before he flew to Australia. He had his shoulder in a sling. He was on painkillers. He was jet-lagged. And he'd had a couple of glasses of wine. So he was somewhat overwhelmed by these things. And there's no sense in what he writes that he was uninterested in Australia and its history. But people
Just given that that's in the book, it shows that he does have an interest.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it doesn't bulk large in his memoir, needless to say, because the position he held involved oversight of a vast range of important concerns, and Australia was a relatively minor one. But Australia gets mentioned a few times, and always with respect. Just going back to your question, I would emphasise two things as to why this memoir is actually significant to Australia. First of all, Gates was an unusual Secretary of Defence and a distinguished one, and he's written a very fine memoir, which gives somebody an overview of how US defence and national security policy really works in a very human way. So given that there's so much vituperation about the United States and its role in the world, and so many Australians ask, should we really be allied to the US? Should we really follow on their coattails? This is an unusually good opportunity to get an insight into how the establishment really works. And the second thing is that it's also a particularly fine example of a civil servant who had a capacity for bipartisanship, for really thinking in terms of the national good across parties rather than being party free, which is somewhat unusual in a lot of ways. He comes across, it seems to me, also as a model civil servant, and we in Australia need very good civil servants, not least in defence. So it should be something of a model and an inspiration to people who want to take that portfolio seriously in this country.
When you look at the idea that he was also head of the CIA, there are always questions put around the CIA. Whenever you think of the CIA, you think, oh, there's something a little bit untrustworthy about the CIA. Does it shine a light and give the CIA a better impression?
Well, of course, you're referring there to his earlier memoir.
Yes.
So there are two books. He had two careers, and for your listeners' sake, I'll just briefly recap on that. He had a career of 25 years in the CIA and rose directly from entry-level analyst all the way through the ranks to be head of intelligence analysis, deputy director of the agency, and then director of central intelligence by the end of his career. That's unique. And his memoir, From the Shadows, written in the 1990s after he'd retired, is an extraordinary insight into how the CIA works. Having retired, he became an academic administrator in Texas, and it was from there that he was asked by George W. Bush, the younger Bush, to step in and become Secretary of Defense. The current memoir is a reflection on his years as Secretary of Defense. But to go back to your question about the CIA, is of course the CIA is everybody's idea of a cloak and dagger secret intelligence organization. And in a democracy, the US or other Western democracies, such organizations tend to be viewed with concern or skepticism or even derision. So it's very useful to have a memoir such as From the Shadows, since here's a man who worked in it from, as I said, the bottom all the way to the top. And moreover, he joined at the height of the Vietnam War in 1965-66. And his first 10 years included the inquiries into the CIA in the mid-1970s, which for the first time really laid bare many of its clandestine operations and its plots against foreign governments and plans for assassinating foreign leaders and all sorts of things.
The reason that I ask you that question is that coming from the history of the CIA, coming into a position of Secretary of Defense, if he brings that knowledge or if he brings that feeling with him of being a former head of the CIA?
Well, he definitely does. It's important to emphasize that while in the CIA, he also had long stints on the National Security Council. So he worked within the White House with four different presidents. And he got an unusually broad and deep understanding of U.S. national security and where intelligence fitted into it and how it was used by the White House and how Congress related to the clandestine services as well as to the White House. So he really got dug in. And it's important to emphasize, and this is very clear in both these books, Gates is nobody's idea of a James Bond figure. As he says, you know, he wasn't cut out for that, and it could be discovered when he joined CIA that that's not what it was about. He was an analyst, and you might say he's a man after my own heart, because that's what I was. He wasn't, in the normal sense of the word, a spy. He wasn't posted abroad to snoop around and collect secrets and recruit agents. He was, throughout his career, a thinker and an analyst and an advisor, a briefer, and he just rose steadily through the ranks, winning respect at every level again and again. And that's why, because he was so widely known after he'd retired, he was asked in 2006 by Bush to step up as Secretary of Defense.
Okay, so why was he chosen? But you've taken a look at that partially. And also, why was it felt that he would be better to replace Donald Rumsfeld?
Well, by 2006, as you and most of your listeners, I suspect, will recall, the war in Iraq had really gone pear-shaped. And Donald Rumsfeld was, in many respects, the figure at the center of that. And George Bush, as president, had decided that we've got a problem here. We've got the strategy wrong. We need to really rethink and reframe what we're doing. Rumsfeld, in particular, became unpopular because he was seen as arrogant and as negligent, as not having thought this through, and that this was, in many respects, his responsibility. And so he stepped down. And why was Gates, in particular, chosen? Well, I think the answer is that he was well known and respected, and what was wanted was a figure who would be seen on a bipartisan basis, hopefully, as respectable. I was just going to say he was very modest about this because he said, you know, I sailed through the congressional approval process, and perhaps this is because at that point in time the mood was anybody other than Rumsfeld.
So it was that ability you talked about, his analytical skills, to be able to sit down and take a look at a situation and weigh things up. Is that what he was then brought in to do? And was he in agreement with what was done beforehand by Rumsfeld?
Well, if by that you mean, did he agree that it was a good idea to have invaded Iraq?
And in such a way.
Yes. He's a little circumspect about that in the memoir, but what he says is this. When he became Secretary of Defense, the biggest issue that confronted the Pentagon and confronted him was, as he puts it, Iraq, Iraq, Iraq. It dominated everything. And he says, regardless of your views, reader, as it were, of the wisdom or otherwise of having entered into the war, we were there. We now had to decide, do we simply give up and pull out? Do we stay the course the way we're going, or do we try again to get this right? And he said, my personal view was that while it may have been unwise to have gone in, if we simply turned tail and got out, if we precipitously withdrew, as many people were urging should be done, that would be calamitous. That would send a very bad signal to all sorts of people around the world. So we had to figure out how to stabilize the situation, how to restore it from the mess that we had unwittingly brought about. And that was what the surge was about. and he had to do a lot of work. This is almost the center point of his memoir as Secretary of Defense, a lot of work to get the Pentagon to really think through how it made war, how it was fighting this conflict, and what could be done.
At the same time, Paul, was he the person that was working with other countries that were involved in the conflict, or was that left to others?
Well, as Secretary of Defense, clearly one of his tasks is to conduct very high-level liaison. But needless to say, the Pentagon in general and the U.S. government in particular is a vast organization. Mm. So that kind of thing was going on at many different levels. He was, it's fair to say, on the other hand, an unusually good person for that kind of thing for two reasons. One is that there were many people overseas, of course, in prominent positions who not only knew who he had been, i.e. director of the CIA, but had dealings with him. He'd been around in the system for such a long time. And he was well regarded because his temperament was calm and even an analytical. There was a character to the man that just quietly won respect. So as Secretary of Defense, he did a lot of work to try to bring the allies and or clients even of the United States into closer alignment in terms of goals. He traveled a great deal, he emphasizes that frequently when he traveled, the accommodation was not what you might think, not exactly five-star. And that he was often jet-lagged and so forth. And like many such senior positions, like being a prime minister or president, you know, the job can wear you down. And he had hoped to do it for 2 years until the end of Bush's presidency and then to return to a quieter life. But Obama asked him to stay on. And this had never happened before. This is worth emphasizing. No Secretary of Defense had previously been asked to stay on to a transition from one president to another, never mind a transition from one party to another. And yet Obama wanted him to stay on. And why? Quite simply because he had won such bipartisan respect for his capacity and his integrity as Secretary of Defense.
Was he? He must have been a good diplomat as well, both within Congress and also with the people that he was working with from other countries who are involved in this conflict. What were his attitudes towards the people that they were fighting?
Well, let's differentiate two things there. The people that you're fighting as, for example, Al-Qaeda or the Taliban in Afghanistan are quite separate from the people of Afghanistan more generally. And similarly in Iraq, what he and others recognized is that they had gone into Iraq naively in the belief that there was Saddam and his terrible government, and then ordinary Iraqis who were just groaning to be free from it, and all he had to do was remove Saddam and everything would be pretty much hunky-dory. Of course, that didn't turn out to be the case at all. There were deep internal ethnic and political divisions and insecurities and fracture lines in the country, and the occupation was mishandled, and those fracture lines simply came apart at the seams, and the country became a mess. So you had to figure out, who are we fighting, who are we liberating, who are we working with here? And that was a very complex jigsaw puzzle. So we had to work overtime to try and get that clear and to find commanders on the ground who were capable of working with these different factions and turning a chaotic and deteriorating situation into one in which more Iraqis than less were saying, we do want peace in the country, do want stability, and we're prepared to work with the Americans to try and achieve that.
And there are also increasingly stories that aren't particularly positive about US forces as well.
Well, indeed. And I said earlier that, the single greatest theme in the biography was his preoccupation with the war in Iraq. Within that, you could almost say that his single greatest preoccupation was the behavior and the well-being of U.S. troops. He really wanted to ensure that the U.S. wasn't creating a mess, but was in fact contributing to the solution, so to speak. And he was particularly keen to cut back on both casualties to U.S. forces. So he worked very, very hard to get greater protection for troops, greater medical care for injured troops, greater care for those invalided out, but also to ensure that operations were conducted in such a way that they weren't generating resentment by causing unintended damage or by generating atrocities.
Paul, you mentioned briefly before the idea of America first going into Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction. Did he feel that it was his role to clear that up and to explain to people that that may not have been, or to clear it up for people, because there was a lot of angst about that?
Yeah, there was. To be honest, he doesn't dwell on the question of weapons of mass destruction, and it's interesting. Being in CIA at the time, he was party to the analysis. He wasn't in CIA at the time. He had been in CIA, so he understood how this analysis was done. I think it's, I should, to the contrary, emphasize that when all of this occurred in 2003, he was well out of government, and so he wasn't party to the decisions that were made. That was one of the reasons probably why it was good to bring him back in. He had clean hands and a fresh perspective. But that said, the issue of WMD at the time, how those assessments were made and how the issue was run politically, is a delicate one. People's feelings ran very high. And it's worth remembering, and Gates was certainly conscious of this, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. He had programs. He'd clung to them tenaciously and tried to prevent the inspectors from finding them. He'd used them, including against his own people. He'd been under a sanctions regime, which itself had been very controversial morally for years because of the effect on Iraqi civilians. So the politics behind the decision to finally get rid of the bugger were complex. But it has to be said that it was a debacle at the end of the day. They went in and they simply didn't find the WMD. It's worth remembering that when they fought the war against Saddam earlier in 1990-91, they discovered that he was much closer at that point to having developed an atomic bomb than they'd ever realised. And I think that did something to shape perceptions in 2002-03, where they thought, you know, sure, we don't have the hard evidence that he's got these things, but then we didn't have the evidence last time. Hmm. So what are we going to do? And the decision was, he's playing a shell game. He's a really dangerous customer. We think we'll take him down. There's a very good debate to be had about whether that was a wise thing to do. But I think it's all put in, it's put in a more lurid perspective by the fact that he was swiftly overthrown, but then things went to hell in a handbasket because of such poor planning about, well, if you do overthrow him, what are you going to do? How are you going to occupy the country? That was where the real mess was created. David Kilcullen, by the way, an Australian who went to the US and got involved in rethinking US military strategy and all of this, contributed greatly to the thinking that went into the surge and the counterinsurgency strategy. But he ended up saying it was a really stupid thing to do, to invade Iraq. It distracted the US from trying to sort Afghanistan out. It consumed enormous resources. It generated enormous controversy. It alienated many people. And there's a lot of wisdom in that point of view. So the thing is, however, that Gates in 2006 inherited that situation. He didn't get to choose whether it would be so. He had to manage it. And he gave it his best shot.
I've got a text here saying that Gates is quite critical of Obama in his book.
Well, I referred to the incident with Kevin Rudd earlier, and it struck me when you saw the early press releases before I'd got a hold of a copy of the book myself that they were saying, oh, he's critical of Obama. This was written up in the Wall Street Journal, for example. When you read the book, you discover that, to put it bluntly, that's nonsense. He lavishes praise on Obama. That he disagreed with Obama about a number of things. They would have some quite strenuous debates about various policy issues, but of course you would. If you've got a thinking president and a very competent Secretary of Defense and you've got very serious challenges, of course you're going to have vigorous debates. But at the pivotal point, right in the center of the book, he spends two paragraphs describing Obama as the most deliberative president that he'd ever worked for, and he worked for eight. He's very impressed by Obama's insistence on thinking things through, on gathering information and analysing things, on really understanding what the issues were, and then adds, but while he was sometimes accused of being dilatory, he was perfectly capable of making decisive life and death decisions when necessary. And also, he says, Obama was always very presidential, conducted himself with great personal dignity and integrity. So the idea that the distinguishing characteristic of his attitude to Obama is he was a Republican critical of the president is simply not true.
Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Trev. The Americans had to go into Iraq, whether they liked it or not, and Rumsfeld screwed it up, basically, and Gates came in and fixed it up with the resurgence of going in and cleaning it up and starting again. They had to go in because Iraq had already invaded Iran and got kicked out. They had invaded Kuwait and had set fire to all the oil wells when they got kicked out. And they were threatening to do the same thing to Saudi Arabia, which would have screwed up the entire oil supply.
Back to Gates, though.
Yeah, Gates. When Gates came in, the surge, as the writer was talking about, he started again. He came in and he took control of everything. He didn't just sort of muck around at the edges like Rumsfeld was doing, trying to do this. He actually got in there with the troops. He got in there and did things, took control, but they mucked it up by trying to turn it into a democracy when they should have turned it over to the tribal heads and made a committee sort of thing out of the tribal heads. It's a tribal situation in the Middle East.
Yeah, just a comment on that, Paul.
Well, a key part of their counterinsurgency strategy was reaching out to the Sunni tribal leaders. But whether you could have put those tribal leaders in control of Iraq as a whole is another matter, because the great division in Iraq was not simply among the tribes in the Sunni triangle. It was between the Kurds in the north, the Shiite Arabs in the south, and the Sunnis in the middle of the country. And the Sunnis were a minority who, under Saddam, had dominated the country, oppressing the Shiites and the Kurds, who, once Saddam was overthrown, were determined that that wasn't going to happen again. So you didn't really have an option of taking a few Sunni tribal leads and saying, well, look, we'll get you now to run the country. Mm. What you had is a situation where Shiite and Sunni Muslims were killing one another brutally and in large numbers, and US military was caught in the middle. And so the question is, well, jeepers, how do we simmer this situation down? And that was a real challenge. And David Petraeus was selected to lead the search because he was one of a very small number of US military officers who, for years beforehand, had been giving very close thought to precisely this kind of challenge.
But of course, one of the big things from there that the US was involved in was trying to find Osama bin Laden. What was his role there?
It was relatively limited, I think you could say. That obviously, he was part of the inner group, and he recounts in a suitably dramatic way how that occurred and how they watched it unfold. But it was, I think... Although it's hard to put this in due proportion, one has the sense that from Gates's point of view, chasing down Osama bin Laden was a clandestine operation for a small number of people. As Secretary of Defense, he had two wars to run. He had a budget to try and bring under control. He had a Pentagon that needed to be steered into thinking in a more innovative and engaged way about the challenges it was facing. He had a hostile Congress. For example, if you go to his index, you'll find that the number of entries in the index under counterinsurgency is a handful. The number under Congress is scores. You could see where, as Secretary, that's where most of his battles were being fought. Yes, he saw the success in finally pinning Obama down and eliminating him obviously, as a signal achievement, but it was not primarily him who was running it.
It's just interesting, as you say that, what he's involved in and doing at that time, and he's got so many fingers in so many pies. Was it also important that he had a strong administration, a strong people around him, and what sort of a boss was he?
Well, needless to say, any senior executive needs good, strong, loyal people around them. Otherwise, their job becomes virtually impossible. He's very critical of quite a few people. It's a very candid memoir, but he does pay tribute to those people around him in the Pentagon with whom he worked closely, who are otherwise unknown to the public eye. They're most unlikely to write memoirs, but he singles them out for praise. It's important to bear in mind just how big the Pentagon is. I mean, Our Department of Defence, including the armed services and the civilians, has 100,000 staff, and that's one of the biggest jobs you can have in Australia. He had run the CIA, which has 100,000 staff. So he'd run at the CIA, an organisation which just on his own, as big as the Australian Defence Establishment. But the Pentagon has 3 million personnel, military and civilians.
Jesus.
Right? So it's just a gigantic job. And there's so many aspects of it. And one of the things that deeply preoccupied him was this thought, which Rumsfeld had shared in his own different way, that the US military was still addicted to building advanced platforms for what had amounted to a Cold War strategic environment and building them in large numbers, where it was by no means clear that this was what the United States and the world now needed. And so one of his constant preoccupations was how to get the Pentagon to rethink what it really needed and its force structure for the 21st century.
So it was not only dealing with what was happening at the time, it's to try and change attitudes for the future.
Indeed, very much so. Looking ahead to, hopefully, resolution of the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan and equipping the United States to make fewer errors and conduct itself more effectively as the 21st century unfolds.
Paul, as you read it, what are the things that you discovered about him that you didn't know before you read the book?
I think the thing that I hadn't appreciated before reading Duty was the quality of Gates's character as a civil servant. I read his memoir from the CIA many years ago, and I had forgotten a good deal of it. I went back to it recently. But what really emerges for me most strongly from his memoir is that this is a really thoughtful, genuinely patriotic guy in a down-to-earth, no-nonsense way. It's not about propaganda. It's not that kind of braggadocio which so many people find rebarbative in some Americans. The idea, you know, we're America and we run the world. And, you know, it's just a kind of human decency. He came from a very unpretentious working family in Kansas, and his father and mother were classic, conservative, decent, honest people who raised him more than anything else, he says, with the stern injunction that he must be honest, and any infraction of that as a boy, would be quite severely punished. So he grew up with this code of honesty, and it's almost a classic American story in that he ends up going to Washington and he becomes both worldly and yet, in a sense, wide-eyed. He never accustoms himself to corruption, to the ways of Congress and the bureaucracy.
Paul, that's where we're going to have to finish. Thank you very much.